Normally, I pick a sutta and read it. I'm going to do something a little different. I want to talk about the suttas in a bit more of a general way. And one of the nice things about living in a monastery or being around monks who do a lot of study of the suttas, once you read the suttas for long enough, you begin to see patterns in the suttas. And oftentimes you don't really see these patterns if you just keep focusing on only one sutta at a time. You know what I mean? But there's bigger patterns when you kind of step back from the suttas and look at them as a big group. Okay? And I feel this is healthy to do sometimes. There's a saying we have in English, can't see the forest for the trees. Can't see the forest for the trees. So if somebody makes the mistake of always looking too closely at details, but they never really step back and look at the big picture, that we would say that person can't see the forest for the trees. Meaning like they keep looking at the individual trees, but what would be helpful is if they step back and looked at the whole forest, which has many trees. So now I often will read suttas out from the Anguttara Nikaya, sometimes the Samyutta. Those are my two favorites. And there's some shorter ones in there just for these shorter talks. But what I never read from is the Digha Nikaya, the longer discourses. Just because, you know, a longer discourse, it doesn't fit into the 15 minutes very well. But there's an interesting pattern in the Digha I'd like to talk about. So the first 13 of those suttas in the Digha, the monks have a name for these 13. It's the silas. The silas. A sila here meaning like morality. And what's interesting about these first 13, and you know, if you are the sort of person who likes reading suttas, you know, you can read it yourself. It's on the internet. So these first 13 all have something in common, which is they have some pretty critical arguments against Brahmin culture at the time of the Buddha. And when Buddhism was eager to convert Indian people, who are usually by default Hindu, these suttas could be shared to offer criticism of Hinduism as it was practiced in those times. It was called Brahmanism back then, but today we would call it Hinduism. And the Brahmins at the time were very powerful and wealthy people. They oftentimes owned a lot of land, a lot of cattle. They were very good friends with powerful kings, powerful rulers, powerful people. And it was kind of risky to cast any doubt on them and to affront them. This word affront means to like challenge their views, to bring the views into question. So these first 13 suttas are kind of daring on the part of the Buddha, because he's kind of pointing out ways that they are sometimes contradictory or even corrupt, you know, how their spirituality is not praiseworthy. Although in other places in the suttas, the Buddha isn't totally one-sided. He will give them credit too sometimes. He will say things like, in the past there were Brahmins who acted in certain ways, they behaved, you know, they practiced in certain ways, and that was praiseworthy actually. There were practices in the past that were, the Buddha knew of them. He could even explain these practices. And he's like, you know, those practices are actually really kind of impressive. Although the Brahmins of his day, this is centuries later, kind of stopped doing these things. So I think that the Buddha was, his criticisms were informed in that he knew about the previous behavior, which was, you might say, more spiritually, I don't know what, skillful or careful or principled, you know. Maybe it wasn't the same practice as the Buddha teaches, but nonetheless, they had a discipline to what they did. They had certain customs around celibacy or, you know, things like this. that weren't really being observed anymore at the time of the Buddha. So I think that the Buddha had a lot of, he had a lot of diplomacy to get away with this. He had a lot of skill in, you might say he had political skill. He had tact, as we say, tact, T-A-C-T. It's like knowing what to say and saying it very carefully without offending people too much. When there are people who can easily get offended, I think the Buddha was a master of knowing just how much he could get away with and then stopping short. There actually was a Brahmin once who came and wanted to kill him. He had a club and he was coming to kill the Buddha with this club. But the Buddha managed to talk some sense into this Brahmin and kind of talk his way out of it, which is, he's very fortunate he managed that. But I think he had pushed the Brahmins to the point where one of them did want to kill him. So that's about as much as you can possibly, you know, get away with, you know. There's another phrase we have in English too, which I think explains this. Knowing when to pick your battles. Knowing when to pick your battles. Meaning like, when we look around us in the world and we see all kinds of problems, okay, it's not hard to see them. We might see political corruption. We might see environment problems or just people behaving in abusive ways. You never know, maybe in our family or our community, in our jobs. You know, we look around us and we see a variety of problems. And it can feel very overwhelming to think about them all at once, okay? There's so many problems in the world that it can be depressing. I don't recommend thinking about them all at once. That's a bad idea. But sometimes we do have to pick our battles. And there maybe is something we can change, and there is something we should do. And I think that the Buddha was kind of a master of this. He knew how to pick his battles. He knew how much he could get away with. And those criticisms that you see in the first 13 suttas of the Digha Nikaya, in the Silas, that is probably about how much he could get away with. There are other places in the suttas as well where he is critical of them as well, but especially those 13 suttas. Yeah, he was also able to get away with starting the Bhikkhuni order. That was a very daring thing to do. Apparently, the Bhikkhuni order was the first order of women to be ordained ever on planet Earth that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of any other religion who had nuns or, you know, female priests or anything like this prior to the Buddha. I think the Buddha had the first women's monastic order. So that's very progressive for him to do that. This is in like ancient India, where it's kind of a very tough place where there's no rule of law. There's no, the king rules the place. The king makes up whatever laws he wants. Whatever he wants to do, he can do it. And there's a lot of fighting and killing, and there was way more violence back then than today. And women's rights were not good back then. Not good at all. Yeah. So anyway, I guess what I'm just pointing out here is like, even though we may think of the Buddha just as somebody who attained enlightenment and taught the monks and the nuns and stayed very much out of politics and stayed away from worldly matters, there were certain times when he would confront people outside of his own religion. He would talk to Brahmins. He would debate with them sometimes. He knew how to pick his battles. Like, there are times when he will stand up for himself and be really brave. And he is an excellent leader that way. He knows the limits, you know, he knows what he can get away with. And over in Christianity, you might argue Jesus wasn't quite so skilled there. He made the Romans quite upset, and he made the Jewish kind of like monastic kind of hierarchy, you know, the priests, he made them angry. he stood up to them in ways that pushed them too far, and he was crucified on the cross for that. Anyway, I don't know, it's just, I find this sort of thing interesting to think about. What battles should we pick, if any? I think that's maybe the lesson here. And we can't win them all, we can't fight them all. Well, there is one piece of Buddhist wisdom here maybe I'll close with. The Buddha teaches, it's in the Anguttara here, it's quite short. It basically goes like this. I'm just paraphrasing. You can tell somebody who is wise because they take care of the things in their immediate life which they can. You know, like whatever problems have come to them personally, they take care of those things. And you can tell a fool because a fool will want to take care of the problems of other people. Problems that aren't their own problems. Okay, so a wise person takes care of the problems that they have. Okay, what problems have come to them? And a fool keeps focusing on everybody else's problems, not his own problems. That is very tempting to do. When we look out in the world, we see all the problems, but how about our own problems? What problems do we have? What is it that we have a hard time with? What ways can we improve our own lives? If we were wise, we would look at ourselves and be honest. What problems should we work on? Never mind other people's problems. It's hard enough to just fix our own issues, our own bad habits or whatever it is. Okay?